So now I'm just going to go into, okay, we know how to do quantum key distribution in theory. How do we do it in reality? So in reality, we use photons to represent our qubits because we know a lot about how to polarize photons, and we know how to send them in channels. So in this case, in the case of quantum cryptography that I'm going to be studying, we're storing our information in the polarization states of single photons. So we all know that photons are both particles, but they also behave like waves. So they have polarizations, and we can say, well, this movement is going to be, this movement that's vertical is going to be our zero basis end. This horizontal movement is going to be our one basis, or that's going to represent our one of our qubit. And then we can rotate this by 45 degrees and get another basis that's pretty much orthogonal to that one. And then all we need to do is just use sort of polarization filters, and that will only let the light pass if it's got a certain polarization. So it's easy to imagine, okay, well, so Alice is over here, and she's going to prepare some photons with specific rotations, and Bob's here. So Bob is also short for Roberta, so I'm just following the trend of having all female experimenters in our examples. So Bob, you can imagine he's got his polarized filter here, and she's just going to flip her filter like randomly to try to see if she can get a photon through. And if a photon goes through, great. She has these detectors that can detect single photons, and they'll click, and then she'll say, oh yeah, I measured that. But what about if, like, this doesn't work if Alice sends a horizontally polarized photon through a vertical lens or a vertical filter? That doesn't really help you. Well, luckily, we have these things called beam splitters. And the two beam splitters we have, one, for example, would be just an ordinary beam splitter. You can sort of imagine it as being like a random direction picker. So when a photon hits it, it's going to come out in this direction sort of at random, or in this direction at random. So that way we can sort of randomly choose between our rectilinear basis, which would be like our 0 and 1 basis that Stacy talked about, or our diagonal basis, which is the plus and minus basis that Stacy talked about. And then the other beam splitter we have is a polarizing beam splitter. And there, it's not choosing the path completely randomly. There, if a vertical photon hits it, it's going to go right through. If a horizontal photon hits it, it's going to be deflected. So in that case, Bob can push one of these streams of photons through a polarizing beam splitter and then through this filter, and the same way down here. And this photon will also go to a detector, and that's great. This means that 50% of the time, he's going to measure in the rectilinear basis, and all of the photons are going to get to the detector, so he'll be able, or she'll be able to completely characterize the polarization state of that photon, assuming that it was in the rectilinear basis. And then down here, the same way, she'll just put a pi over 4 rotation plate here, and then do the same thing. Polarizing beam splitter, this goes out to a detector, and this also goes to a detector. So what we have here is that we're just using quantum physics to choose randomly what basis we're measuring in. And then when we choose that basis, then we're doing a full projective measurement on that state. So this is great, but how do we generate the photons? Well, the most commonly used way of doing this is just using a pulsed laser. So you have a pulsed laser here. You attenuate it so that you assume that there's probably only one photon in each of these pulses. And then Alice has some polarization modulators, which are actually very common in our standard optical telecommunications industry. So she's got some machine here that can, where the electronics sort of randomly chooses a basis to send out. So this is great. This has been shown, we have tons and tons of papers showing how great this is and how we can share keys, and there are actually companies in Switzerland that can build these things and sell them to you. But the problem is that, first of all, you need a pulse laser. Like Joe Blow in the IT department of some university that wants to do quantum cryptography, he's not going to have a pulse laser sitting around. He's also probably not going to have all this expensive telecommunications equipment. And also, there are some attacks that can attack this because you can't guarantee that each of these pulses is just going to be one photon. Like, there are some attacks that involve, okay, well, what if there are two photons here? Let's just take what Eve's going to take one out and measure it, and it won't affect what Bob gets, but Eve will know all the information about that photon that Bob can get. So another method of doing cryptography that's sort of less well used because you can't generate qubits as fast is using entanglement. So some of you might know nonlinear optics. I don't really want to explain it. Just pretend like it's magic, and we have some ability to take one high-energy photon and break it into two smaller, lower-energy photons. But during this process, we can configure it so that the momentum has to be conserved. And in certain configurations, the way you conserve this momentum is by having one of the photons that comes out of this be horizontally polarized and the other one being vertically polarized. So this is great. What we do with this is then we take this, we can build it into some loops. The magic is happening in this crystal down here. And what happens is that you have your high-energy photons. This is sort of the random splitter, so that randomly half the time it will come around this way, and half the time it will go around this way. And depending on which way it went through the loop, Alice is going to get a vertical photon, and Bob will get a horizontal photon, or vice versa. So they come out in pairs. So whenever Alice measures a vertically polarized photon, she knows that Bob has to measure it, a horizontally polarized photon, and vice versa. So you have an entangled state. And then this way, no one sort of creates and prepares the photons. You just have Alice and Bob making these same measurements and assuming that they're correlated and then building a key out of that. So, and this is actually quite, this is really, really cheap and a lot easier to set up than the single or the weak coherent pulse method of doing cryptography. So now that we have this, what sort of channel should we use? Well, if we want to make this like implementation of quantum cryptography that anyone could do, even if they don't have that much money, then we want to sort of use existing infrastructure. So we're moving more and more towards optical fibers for our telecommunications traffic. And this is great, except that if you're trying to do quantum information and you're trying to combine it with classical information, the quantum information is really, really touchy compared to the classical information. So the quantum information, usually most implementations use dark fibers, so they just send their qubits down. There's no interaction with any other sorts of light. There are implementations that involve sending your classical communication and your quantum communication down the same fibers, but these are really, really tricky to do. They require a lot of noise cancellation, and there's still a lot of mixing, so just because of scattering between the light. So what we're trying to do is show that you can do this quantum key distribution in existing telecommunications fibers. And the way that we're doing this is we have, if you look at fibers, most of the really, really low loss fibers are single mode fibers, so they only let one wavelength of light through at once. This is based on their core size. So the larger the core size, the greater the wavelength of light they're designed for. So, but this means that so the lowest loss happens at infrared frequencies. So a lot of the telecommunications fibers that are used are for these infrared frequencies. So they're single mode fiber, so it means that if you put infrared light in, no, like that should be the only light in. But because they're so large, you can actually fit lower wavelengths of light in. It just means that they're not going to, the lower wavelengths of light aren't going to see them as single mode fibers. This is an example, for example. So basically, the infrared light sees the fiber as a single mode fiber. Any smaller type of light is going to see that as a multimode fiber. So what we can do is we can combine our telecom signal, which is going to carry our classical information, which can handle a lot of loss and can handle a lot of stuff being done to it, with our quantum information, which is going to be visible light. And that's because the equipment that we use is a lot better for visible light than it is for non-visible light. And we're just going to combine them on the same fiber and try to see whether they really interact. I mean, the farther away the wavelengths are from each other, the less they're going to scatter with each other in the fiber. So unfortunately, this means that we're going to have to deal with some loss, because these fibers really aren't designed for visible light. So they experience, so visible light going through these fibers is going to experience a whole lot more loss than the wavelengths of light they're designed for. But there is this sort of range on short wavelengths where the visible light still can make it through the fiber without too much loss, or without too much loss that we couldn't be able to do quantum key distribution. So this is sort of the thing that we're trying to do, just show for short distances you can use the existing infrastructure and you don't have to deal with a whole bunch of complicated signal processing due to the mixing between our quantum signal and our classical signal. So so here's some experimental results. What I did was I have this Sagnac source. I put in the middle, put some fiber lengths on the side, and these go to our Alice and Bob modules like I've drawn on the board before. And what I did was I just hooked it up to a computer in the middle and just tried to generate a whole bunch of traffic and tried to see whether this actually affected the quantum signal. So here on this graph, I don't know if you can see it, but I've got two different experimental data points. One of them corresponds to a whole bunch of traffic like you would see on an optical fiber between two buildings, for example, and one where I just do it where there's no classical information, like dark fibers, nothing for the quantum signal to mess around with. And it ends up being pretty much the same, within experimental error. So we did this up to 3 kilometers per arm, which means that we can do a total distance of 6 kilometers if we put the source in the middle. And this is our sort of our simulation of what we're doing. And so our simulation predicts that if we wanted to trade off some of our secure key rate, we could make this go out to 4 kilometers, so it means 8 kilometers total distance. And then after that, we were like, well, we didn't really think about what the optimal, this was just sort of a proof of concept. So we took the same simulation and sort of optimized the parameters. We optimized the amount of entangled pairs that come out. We optimized sort of the timing resolution of our detectors. And we think that with these optimized parameters, which are completely achievable with current technology, this system could go out to 8 kilometers, which would mean 16 kilometers total distance. Also, we looked at how the cuber was affected. So Stacy didn't really get to this in her talk. Well, she got to it at the very, very end. So the idea is that if an eavesdropper looks at your channel and just sort of tries to do the same measurements and get the same information out, she's going to produce errors in the signal. So for example, Alice sends out a zero in the rectilinear basis, and then Eve randomly chooses the rectilinear basis. She's going to measure a zero, and she can just measure that and then just send out another zero. Assuming Bob also measures in the zero basis, he'll just also see a zero, like nothing ever happened, like no eavesdropper was in the middle. However, if, for example, Eve chooses the diagonal basis and Alice prepared in the rectilinear basis, then when Alice measures the qubit, she's going to measure it in a diagonal state. So she's going to send out a diagonal state when she got a rectilinear state. So when Bob sees this, if he measures in the correct basis, he's just going to get a random qubit because he's measuring this diagonal qubit with a rectilinear basis. So this is going to produce detectable errors in the experiment. And there's sort of a maximum, in the limit of Eve choosing a whole bunch of measurement bases, there's some maximal amount of error she can produce in the signal. So if we do this protocol and our error rates are lower than the maximum that Eve could generate, or the minimum rather that Eve can generate, then we can be fairly certain that Eve is not present in our channel. And that limit, theoretically, is around 13% experimentally due to the limitations of our current detector technology. It's more like 11%. So this is this concept of qubit. It's really important to keep track of, as well as the key rates that we're generating when we're doing these experiments. And because this is like a really, this is the important part of QKD, we can look at how much error does our classical signal introduce into our quantum bit error rate. So here, I guess the yellow doesn't turn out very well, but what I've done here is just shown one run of generating secure keys and plotted with the cuber. So the cuber is along here. It starts off like 2.5. It gets up to about 8 at the end of the experiment. And that's just due to mechanical relaxation of our fibers. Like in any QKD system, the error is just sort of going to increase over time. And there are, in the commercially available systems, there are many ways of dealing with this where you just sort of stop generating key for a second, realign your bases, and continue. So this isn't, like, this is sort of expected. This is what we would see even if there was no classical traffic. And here I just generate a whole bunch of classical traffic in megabits per second, just kept doubling the amount of traffic up until the maximum that I could generate. And as you can see, the cuber is just like happily increasing with mechanical relaxation. Doesn't seem to notice the effect of classical traffic at all. So this is pretty good. Means that our classical traffic really isn't doing anything to the quantum signal. And ultimately, what this means is that if you have, say, a bank, or you have, I don't know, any business where you have important information, or maybe it's like a polling station and you want to securely transfer your results back to headquarters, this means that this system could work up to a distance of 16 kilometers. That covers a lot of most university campuses, probably the distance between RIM-owned buildings in Waterloo. And it means, and a lot of times the sort of fiber optic links between these buildings are controlled in-house. Like they have a central IT room. In our case, it would be on the first floor of the math building. And what you would do is you just have an entangled source. You'd say, hey, person in IT who I trust, or you don't even have to trust him because you've got an entangled state. You could just measure whether you've actually got an entangled state with your partner in another building. And you just say, okay, plug me into the entangled state, and you just keep going, and there's no disruption to the classical traffic, no need to install new fibers, no need for a pulsed laser. Just get your crystal, get a physicist to set it up, and then it's good to go. So I guess that's my conclusion again.